Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Half a century ago, the U.S. Supreme Court settled the matter of when a court can stop a newspaper from publishing. In 1971, the Nixon administration attempted to block the New York Times and the Washington Post from publishing classified Defense Department documents detailing the history of the Vietnam War, the so-called Pentagon Papers. The opinion article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times. The piece is titled, A Dangerous Court Order Against the New York Times. Half a century ago, the U.S. Supreme Court settled the matter of when a court can stop a newspaper from publishing. In 1971, the Nixon administration attempted to block the New York Times and the Washington Post from publishing classified Defense Department documents detailing the history of the Vietnam War, the so-called Pentagon Papers. Faced with an asserted threat to the nation's security, the Supreme Court sided with the newspapers. Without an informed and free press, they cannot be an enlightened people, Justice Potter Stewart wrote in a concurring opinion. That sentiment reflects one of the oldest and most enduring principles in our legal system. The government may not tell the press what it can and what it cannot publish. This principle long predates the Constitution, but so there would be no mistake. The nation's founders included a safeguard in the Bill of Rights anyway. Congress shall make no law, the First Amendment says, abridging the freedom of speech or the freedom of the press. This is why virtually every official attempt to bar speech or news reporting in advance, known as a prior restraint, gets struck down. Any system of prior restraints of expression comes to this court bearing a heavy presumption against its constitutional validity, the Supreme Court said in a 1963 case. Such restraints are the very prototype of the greatest threat to First Amendment values, Justice Antonin Scalia wrote a generation later. On Friday, 24th of December, however, a New York trial court judge broke from the precedent when he issued an order blocking the New York Times from publishing or even reporting further on information it had obtained relating to the Project Veritas. The conservative sting group that traffics in hidden cameras and fake identities to target liberal politicians and interest groups, as well as traditional news outlets. The order, a highly unusual and astonishingly broad injunction against the news organization, was issued by State Supreme Court Justice Charles D. Wood, who wrote that the New York Times decision to publish excerpts from memos written by Project Veritas's lawyers cries out for court intervention to protect the integrity of the judicial process. This ruling follows a similar directive Justice Wood issued last month in response to a story the New York Times published that quoted from the memos. The New York Times plans to appeal this latest ruling. in requesting the order from Justice Wood, Project Veritas's lawyers acknowledged that prior restraints on publication are rare, but argued that their case fits a narrow exception the law recognizes for documents that may be used in the course of ongoing litigation. This exception recognizes that because parties are forced by the court to disclose materials, courts should have the power to supervise how such forced disclosures are used by the other party. The litigation here is a libel suit Project Veritas filed against the New York Times in 2020 for its articles on a video the group produced about what it claimed was rampant voter fraud in Minnesota. The video was probably part of a coordinated disinformation effort, the New York Times reported, citing an analysis by researchers at Stanford University and at University of Washington. The group's lawyers also argue that the memos are protected by attorney-client privilege and that the New York Times was under an ethical obligation to return them to Project Veritas rather than publish them. This is not how journalism works. The New York Times, like any other news organization, makes ethical judgments daily about whether to disclose secret information from governments, corporations, and others in the news. But the First Amendment is meant to leave those ethical decisions to journalists, not to courts of law. The only potential exception is information so sensitive, say planned troop movements during a war, that its publication could pose a grave threat to American lives or to national security. Project Veritas's legal memos are not a matter of national security. In fact, but for its ongoing libel suit, the group would have no claim against the New York Times at all. The memos at issue have nothing to do with that lawsuit and did not come to the New York Times through the discovery process. Still, Project Veritas is arguing that their publication must be prohibited because the memos contain confidential information that is relevant to the group's litigation strategy. It's an absurd argument and a deeply threatening one to a free press. Consider the consequences. News organizations could be routinely blocked from reporting information about a person or a company simply because the subject of that reporting decided the information might one day be used in litigation. More alarmingly is the prospect that reporters could be barred even from asking questions of sources, lest someone says something that turns out to be privileged. This isn't a speculative fear. In his earlier order, Justice Wood barred the New York Times from reporting about anything covered by Project Veritas's attorney-client privilege. In Friday's decision, he ordered the New York Times to destroy any and all copies of the memos that it had obtained, and barred it from reporting on the substance of these memos. The press is free to report on matters of public concern, he wrote, but memos from attorneys to their clients don't clear that bar. This is a breathtaking rationale. Justice Wood has taken it upon himself to decide what the New York Times can and cannot report on. That's not how the First Amendment is supposed to work. Journalism, like democracy, thrives in an environment of transparency and freedom. No court of law should be able to tell the New York Times or any other news organization, or for that matter, Project Veritas, how to conduct its reporting. Otherwise, it would provide an incentive for any reporter's subjects to file frivolous libel lawsuits as a means of controlling news coverage about them. More to the point, it would subvert the values embodied by the First Amendment and hobble the functioning of the free press on which a self-governing republic depends.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and especially the people. And as always, we will explore and explain its geopolitics, untangle the arguments from different perspectives, and make the alternative voices heard. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will look at the recent civilian killings in the northeastern Indian state of Nagaland and why calls are growing louder for the repeal of a controversial law. And we shall discuss the breach of religious freedom in Indian-controlled Kashmir, vis-à-vis the closure of the region's central mosque and a ban on Muharram processions.
The recent civilian killings in India's Nagaland state have reignited the long-running debate over a controversial law that confers armed forces with unbridled powers, prompting the Provincial Legislative Assembly to unanimously pass a resolution calling for its abrogation. The trigger was the killing of six coal mine workers early this month in a botched counter-insurgency operation. In the ensuing clashes, seven more civilians were killed. The incidents sparked widespread protests in Nagaland and fueled calls for the repeal of the law.
On the fateful evening of December the 4th, Indian Army soldiers opened fire at a pickup truck carrying coal miners in Nagaland's Mon district. Six civilians were killed on the spot. Later that day, seven more civilians and a soldier died in clashes between people and police. On December the 5th, one more civilian was shot dead when angry protesters ambushed an army camp. Army soldiers had apparently mistaken the group of coal miners for insurgents. India's Home Minister Amit Shah said the government regretted what he called the unfortunate incident, describing civilian killings as the case of mistaken identity. In the days after Shah's statement, angry protesters filled the streets across Nagaland and adjoining states, demanding the minister's apology and, more importantly, calling for the repeal of Armed Forces Special Powers Act, a draconian law that provides grounds for men in uniform in India's so-called disturbed areas to commit horrendous human rights abuses. On December the 20th, the Nagaland State Assembly unanimously passed a resolution demanding that the BJP government at centre repeal the controversial and much-abused law from the state and from the rest of the northeast. It also demanded that the appropriate authority issue an apology for the massacre and that justice be delivered to the perpetrators.
It's not the first instance that the Armed Forces Special Powers Act has hogged headlines for the wrong reasons. The controversial law, enacted in 1958 to maintain control and curb insurgency in what the Indian government considered disturbed areas, is in force in at least five Indian states. The legislation has drawn flak from national and international human rights watchdogs as it gives unbridled powers and immunity to the armed personnel to shoot, kill, make arrests on flimsy pretexts, conduct searches without warrant, and demolish structures.
The controversial law, also known as AFSPA, was first enacted in 1958 to allow deployment of armed forces to counter a secessionist movement in the hills of Nagaland. Six decades later, it is in force in Manipur, Assam, parts of Arunachal Pradesh, and in the Union Territory of Jammu and Kashmir, the places labeled as disturbed areas. The legislation gives license to Indian Army soldiers to carry out excesses without fear of legal prosecution, even when they kill and injure people, raid houses without warrant, or use deadly and indiscriminate force on mere suspicion, like the case of Nagaland killings. The law has long shielded Indian soldiers stationed in the so-called disturbed areas from accountability for grave human rights abuses and has denied justice to to the affected families. A 2019 report on Jammu and Kashmir by the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said the law remains a key obstacle to accountability. Following the latest incident in Nagaland, which has shaken the conscience of the nation of 1.3 billion people, calls for repealing the law have grown louder in all northeastern states. But will the BJP government in New Delhi move to abolish it? No one is quite ready to bet on that.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Kalol Bhattacharjee, Senior Assistant Editor with the Hindu newspaper. Now, welcome to the program, Mr. Bhattacharjee. Let's begin with the recent civilian killings in northeast India's Nagaland state, which have reignited the long-running debate about the use and abuse of the Armed Forces Special Powers Act. Now, can you tell us what exactly happened in Nagaland?
Hello, thank you so much for inviting me to this bulletin and this discussion on the developments regarding AFSPA or AFSPA, as we call it in India. What happened that evening in Nagaland is that a group of daily wage workers were returning home from their work in a nearby mine. And while they were returning, they were ambushed by a group of Indian soldiers who also were reportedly working on solid intelligence inputs that a group of insurgents were waiting to carry out an attack on the Indian soldiers. And so the report that came later on to us is that these soldiers were targeted by these, were to be targeted by these reported insurgents, and therefore this ambush was carried out in a defensive way so that insurgents could be neutralized. However, later on we heard that the issue was of mistaken identity, as it was claimed by the Indian Home Minister in the Parliament, and that the soldiers felt that they were going to be ambushed by a group of insurgents, and therefore they acted in self-defense. But very soon we got to know that the local villagers were the first to arrive at the scene, and they discovered that the bodies of those people who had been shot dead were being loaded onto a jeep or some other vehicles that the army soldiers were driving around in. So the local villagers came, and then they attacked the Indian soldiers, and which really led to a massive mayhem at that point. And that was the main reason that an Indian soldier also lost his life. It was, in brief, the entire sequence of events.
So, Mr. Bhattacharjee, this much-abused law grants the Indian Army unbridled powers to maintain public order in so-called disturbed areas. Now, do you think this is a smokescreen to escape accountability for human rights abuses?
I would also like to mention that this particular area of Nagaland is very close to the international border with Myanmar. And also, please remember that the crisis in Myanmar has been escalating over the last 8 months or so. And the international community has not really acted in a collective manner to ensure any sort of pressure on the Myanmarese junta. What's happening as a result is that there is a spillover effect on the nearby areas, especially on India's northeastern areas, where a lot of the smuggling activities have heightened, because the Myanmar rulers themselves are involved in drugs and other sorts of smuggling activities. And what's of great concern is that apart from the exodus of people from Myanmar, there is also this influx of these goods and items and drugs into India's border areas and also into Bangladesh. So this has also heightened tension among the heightened tension as well as distrust among the armed forces or the law enforcement agencies, as well as the locals and those people who are involved in those sort of activities, illicit activities. So this basically, in the context of this particular development in India's neighboring Myanmar, what's happening is that this kind of a law, that is a law like AFSPA, has more chances of getting abused, because if there is faulty information or intelligence about a certain movement of drugs, a movement of insurgents, then you know these sort of laws actually you know increase the chances of such incidents you know being repeated in future as well.
Like you've mentioned, there have been numerous protests in northeastern Indian states as well as in Jammu and Kashmir against this law over the years. Now, how do Indian authorities justify its continued use?
Well, as you understand, the situation in Kashmir has been problematic for a very long time because of India's position as well as because of Pakistan's perceived interference. What happens in Kashmir is that the law and order situation on the ground is always very fragile because of cross-border attempts from the Pakistani side to keep the pot boiling in Kashmir, and on the ground level you have lot of presence, with a big presence of the ultras or the other, you know, insurgents from the other side are always, present in some numbers. So that is one issue which the Indian state has often cited as one of the main reasons why it has kept AFSPA in Kashmir. And that is often the only answer that we have received from the Indian state or whenever the extra-legal developments have taken place in Kashmir. Having said that, I must say that that is not the only legal instrument in the hands of the Indian state as far as Kashmir is concerned, because the region is highly militarized, and you know, in that context, not a very normal governance process can't really function, and therefore the Kashmiri situation is very unique, and the Indian state has often cited that as one of the main reasons that has enabled its use of AFSPA on the ground in Kashmir.
Before we let you go, sir, one last question. Why has there been no international outcry over the Indian government's use of the controversial law?
Well, there has not been any international outcry on the AFSPA, primarily because India prides itself on its democratic credentials. But also please remember that after this particular incident took place in Nagaland, whether we call it an outcry or not, the issue of AFSPA or the abuse of such extra-legal matters or laws by the enforcement agencies or the Indian Armed Forces has been taken up by the UN Human Rights Council.
Mr. Bhattacharjee, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people on social media see the situation.
Senior Indian journalist Supriya Sharma says the families of civilians killed by the Indian Army in Nagaland have refused government compensation until the culprits are punished and the controversial law is repealed. Conrad Sangma, the Chief Minister of Northeastern Indian State of Meghalaya, extends his support to protesters in Nagaland in their demand to have AFSPA repealed from the Northeast. A legislator from northwestern Gujarat state, Jignesh Mavani, says the Nagaland killings should force authorities to rethink and review the draconian law so that accountability can be fixed.
You're listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The centuries-old central mosque in the summer capital of Indian-controlled Kashmir has remained largely locked for the past 2 years since the abrogation of the region's special status sparked unrest. Built in the 15th century, the mosque is seen by Indian authorities as a trouble spot. It's a place where Kashmiri Muslims gather to offer Friday prayers and to raise voice for their legitimate political aspirations. They see its closure as denial of their right to religious freedom.
The closure of the Himalayan region's 600-year-old central mosque known as Jamia Masjid and denial of permission to Kashmiri Muslims to hold the congressional Friday prayers for the past 2 years has deepened anger and resentment among them. The mosque was shut down immediately after the Narendra Modi-led BJP government in New Delhi stripped Indian-controlled Kashmir of its semi-autonomous status. In the past 2 years, which have been marked by intermittent protests and shutdowns, the historic mosque has remained out of bounds to worshippers on Fridays, even though authorities allow it to remain open on other days. Jamia Masjid has played a key role in the region's turbulent history. It has traditionally been the bastion of resistance against Kashmir's autocratic rulers. In 1819, Sikh rulers had closed it for 21 years. During the rule of Dogra Hindu dynasty between 1846 and 1947, the mosque often remained shut. In the past 30 years, since the anti-India resistance gained momentum in Kashmir, Jamia Masjid has been subject to periodic bans and lockdowns by successive Indian governments. The chief priest of the mosque and senior pro-freedom leader, Mirwaz Umar Farooq, has often delivered fiery political speeches from the mosque's pulpit, highlighting the political struggle of Kashmiris. Interestingly, in the year 1980, during his visit to Kashmir, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had also delivered a historic sermon at the mosque, which focused on Shia-Sunni unity.
While the Indian government, as part of sweeping measures to crush political dissent, has imposed a tougher security clampdown in Indian-controlled Kashmir since October 2019, infringement of religious freedom has been a long-lasting phenomenon in the disputed region. Besides closing mosques and putting religious leaders and clerics under house arrest, there is a long-running ban on the historic Muharram temple session in Srinagar city, which Kashmiri Muslims see as a blatant breach of their religious freedom.
Muharram processions in Kashmir date back to the early 16th century, when both Shia and Sunni Muslims would come together to parade the streets on the day of Ashura. The processions were banned during the rule of Afghans, followed by Mughals, Sikhs and Dogras, who had a hostile attitude towards Shias. However, in the latter part of the Dogra rule in the late 19th century, the tradition was revived with the cooperation of both the communities. In 1989, when armed resistance against the Indian rule began in Kashmir, the government of India moved swiftly to impose a ban on the procession as part of sweeping measures to deal with the political unrest. Almost 33 years later, the ban remains in place. Each year, police impose curfew-like restrictions on Muharram 8th and 10th in the heart of Srinagar city to foil the Muharram processions. And each year, thousands of mourners defy the ban and carry out peaceful processions while being subjected to brutal police action. Mourners are intercepted by heavily armed police and paramilitary personnel who fire tear smoke canisters and resort to baton charge. Last year, dozens of them were arrested who spent months in jail. Despite repeated pleas, the successive Indian governments have refused to lift the illegal ban.
Now, to have more insight, I would like to welcome Mr. Zamir Ahmed Awan to the program. He is an ex-diplomat and political analyst. Mr. Awan, the centuries-old Grand Mosque of Kashmir has remained closed for the past 2 years. Why is the historic mosque seen as a trouble spot by Indian authorities?
Thank you very much for inviting me to give my comments. In fact, it is a symbolic mosque. It belongs to the Islamic history and represents the Muslim community in the Kashmir. Historically, India was ruled by the Muslim for almost 800 years, and there was a complete harmony between the Muslims and the other religions in India under the Islamic rule. Since the India got independence in 1947, for almost seven decades, Muslims and other minorities in India were living almost peacefully. But since the BJP government took power under the leadership of Narendra Modi, the extremist wings like RSS are promoting hate against the minorities, especially against the Muslims. And they have agenda to purify the India as a pure Indian state without any other religion. So they are also harming other religion in addition to the Muslims, like Christians, Sikhs, and Buddhists, and all other religion. Especially in the Kashmir, where the Muslims are in the majority, they are more harming the Muslims. And this mosque has historical importance. That's why they have closed for the almost couple of years.
Mr. Awan, the Hindu nationalist government in New Delhi has taken many controversial measures since October 2019. Now, do you see the closure of the mosque as part of a plan to deny Kashmiris their religious freedom?
You are absolutely right. Since 2019, Narendra Modi, when won the election, his slogan was to convert the India into a pure Hindu state. And he has got the support from all the extremist Hindu groups like RSS. And as per his agenda, as per his promise in the election, he have to take severe and extremist measures against the minorities, not only against the Muslim, but also against the Christian and other religions also, like amended Citizen Act, cancelling the constitution and occupying the occupied Kashmir, and also many other measures which are extremist, and that is the part of their political plan, and they might do something more harmful to the Muslims.
So for Muslims in Kashmir, the mosque closure also brings painful memories from the past. Why has this mosque always been at the center of political storm?
Always the center point for the political activities in Kashmir. The Muslim freedom movement in Kashmir is always having meetings there and gathering there, and a lot of protest against the Indian government was originated from this mosque. And in past also the Indian security forces has sealed it and closed it for many times, but recently they have taken various prolonged action to close down this mosque. I think it is political motivated and ill planned.
Mr. Awan, the Indian government has also not allowed the historic Muharram procession to take place in the Srinagar city for the past 3 decades. Now, why is it afraid of peaceful religious practices of Kashmiri Muslims?
In fact, the Indian government is suppressing the Muslims and not allowing them to perform their religious duties. The procession of Muharram is a ritual and has been performing for many centuries peacefully, but Indian government is afraid when the Muslims are gathered, they might protest against the government, or they might make some slogans against the government. So in preventing such a situation, they have not allowed the Muharram procession for several years. In fact, not only the Muharram procession, but also other religious activities also are banned.
Mr. Awan, while Muslims are barred from exercising their right to religious freedom, Hindus are allowed to perform their religious rites, even publicly. Now, do these double standards point to something deeply sinister?
In India, there are many other religions and minorities. The dominating is the Brahman, which are only 8% of the whole population. But they are in power, they are in the government, they are in the bureaucracy, they are in the security forces, they are in the police, they are in the district management, and they are controlling all these things. And they are suppressing the Muslims, especially in the Kashmir, where Muslims are in the majority.
Mr. Awan, thank you for being on the program. Love to talk to you again. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Zubair Amin, a Kashmir-based independent journalist, notes that Kashmiri Muslims have long accused New Delhi of curbing their religious freedom on the pretext of law and order, while promoting and patronizing the annual Hindu pilgrimage. Multimedia journalist from Kashmir, Mukhtar Zahur, pictures a man who traveled 40 kilometers to offer Friday prayers at Kashmir's Central Mosque, only to realize that it has been shut. Masroor Ansari, a senior Kashmiri pro-freedom leader, slams the Kashmir police for brutal use of force to thwart a peaceful Muharram procession in Srinagar recently.
And that was our episode about the growing calls in India for the repeal of a controversial law in the wake of the recent civilian killings in Nagaland state and also the denial of religious freedom to Kashmiri Muslims by the Indian government. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The familiar maxim, if at first you don't succeed, try again, that we pass along to our children, encourages resilience and perseverance in the face of failure. We have reason to think someone encouraged former President Donald Trump to take the expression to heart. And unfortunately, he did. The article you're about to hear has been written by MSNBC opinion columnist Jessica Levinson. The piece is titled, Donald Trump's lawsuit against New York Attorney General Letitia James sets him up for another loss. The familiar maxim, if at first you don't succeed, try again, that we pass along to our children, encourages resilience and perseverance in the face of failure. We have reason to think someone encouraged former President Donald Trump to take the expression to heart. And unfortunately, he did. The many lawsuits Donald Trump and his allies filed in 2021, the vast majority of which he lost, provide a case study in perseverance. Trump persevered despite the fact that doing so was often irrational and immoral. There are few truisms in life, but here's one. Trump is litigious, very litigious. Before the 2016 presidential election, a USA Today analysis found that he and his businesses had been involved in 4,095 lawsuits over three decades, and in more than 2,100 of those lawsuits as the plaintiff. Lawsuits, even ones that are destined to fail, can still lead to success. Filing a lawsuit can scare people. Lawsuits are often costly and time-consuming to defend against. Filing a lawsuit can also lead to beneficial delays, like, to take two wild hypotheticals, delaying a state investigation into potentially fraudulent behavior, or a congressional investigation into an insurrection. Let's begin with the lawsuits related to the 2020 presidential election, some of which commenced before 2021. A quick reminder, Joe Biden won that election. As a direct and entirely predictable result of winning a presidential election, Biden is now the President of the United States. Also, you can search and search for massive voter fraud that led to Biden's win, but it will be less fruitful than searching for a snow leopard in a blizzard, and you will come up empty. The only significant fraud perpetrated in the 2020 presidential election is the lie that there was massive voter fraud. It should therefore come as no surprise that lawsuits filed by Donald Trump and his allies claiming there was fraud in the 2020 presidential election, failed. Failed might be too tepid a word to describe the fate of these election-related lawsuits. These lawsuits belly-flopped into a pool containing nothing but air and concrete. By one estimate, Trump and his allies have a win-loss ratio of 0 to 40 when it comes to post-election lawsuits. Let's continue our tour of Donald Trump's lawsuits by moving on to something that happened right after the election, the insurrection and the effort to stop the election certification. The House of Representatives Select Committee is investigating the events of 6th of January to determine who knew what and when. In more predictable news, the man who led our government then and apparently tried to subvert the peaceful transfer of power from himself to Joe Biden doesn't want Congress looking under the hood to find out exactly what happened before and on 6th of January. Donald Trump sued to prevent the committee from obtaining certain White House documents related to the insurrection. He lost in trial court and again in the appeals court. Never one to be deterred by the law or by the facts, Donald Trump has appealed to the Supreme Court for emergency relief. Stay tuned to see what our nation's highest court does. And just when we thought the year might end before another big Trump lawsuit hit, the former president sued New York Attorney General Letitia James. Letitia James's office is investigating whether the Trump Organization may be civilly liable or, among other things, inflating property values to obtain loans and deflating property values to get beneficial tax treatment. Letitia James's office is also working with the Manhattan District Attorney's Office on a criminal investigation into similar alleged behavior. Donald Trump has not been accused of wrongdoing in the investigations. Donald Trump's argument is that Letitia James's investigation is politically motivated and she must restrict it or halt it altogether. If your bingo card had Trump calling James's inquiry a political witch hunt, then place a marker on that square. It is worth noting that Trump's lawsuit arrived on the courthouse doorstep shortly after Letitia James's office subpoenaed Donald Trump for testimony. As is often the case with his lawsuits, Trump's only problem with his lawsuit against Letitia James is that the law is against him. Prosecutors can have political biases without violating the constitutional rights of the people the prosecutor is investigating. That prosecutor simply must set them aside while doing her job. This is but a tour of some of the highlights or lowlights of the cases that Donald Trump and his allies filed in 2021. If we endeavor to provide an exhaustive list, it would almost certainly be out of date before it was finished, as Donald Trump would likely have filed another lawsuit by then. So, kids, aim high, try hard, and persevere. But if you're thinking of filing a lawsuit, check to see if you have a legally recognizable claim. With that, let's say goodbye to 2021 and the many hours Donald Trump's lawyers have billed on his behalf.
Economic divide.
the U.S. dollar is under threat. And the way it's reacting to it, well, it's not reacting as fast as it should. It may not be able to prevent it. The threat, digital currencies, and no, it's not just Bitcoin or the likes. Hi, I'm Kavit Hathaway. In this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at why the dollar is under threat and explore what other countries are doing about digital currencies. Coming up in this program, CBDC, issued by central banks, central bank digital currencies. 90 countries are looking at it. That may pose a threat to the U.S. dollar and its dominance. One of the things we'll be looking at in this program. Also, the U.S. is losing the global race to decide the future of money, and it could doom the dollar, having trouble even concluding its multi-year exploration into the possibility of an e-dollar. So is the dollar doomed to fail by taking its time? We'll have to find out. And finally, U.S. sanctions, a foreign policy tool for the U.S., may lose its efficiency. CBDC challenging these sanctions. And of course, as a result, the U.S. sanctions may be under threat.
Digital currencies. They're called central bank digital currencies, or CBDCs. CBDCs will become more commonplace sooner than one can imagine.
It is a revolution because of the tremendous opportunity this shift in payment systems to central bank digital currency, stable coins, provides to us as consumers in terms of speed, cost, accessibility.
Eighty-seven countries are investigating its usage. They account for over 90% of the world's gross domestic product. Potentially, countries representing one-fifth of the world's population may issue a digital currency in the next few years. Just a hype? Not so, since it has happened already. As of today, 9 countries have now fully launched a digital currency, including China, Sweden, the Bahamas, the Eastern Caribbean Currency Union, and the Marshall Islands.
The digital yuan is definitely a key element to the digital economy. And, it's a fiat, digital fiat in the essence, but deployed on a blockchain.
Okay, social media posts. That's what we're going to be looking at in this section. And the post on this topic was just really overwhelming. Naturally, of course, that's because the crypto craze is still in full effect, whether it's Bitcoin or other digital currencies, and it doesn't look like it's going to go away anytime soon. Our first entry actually covers India. XDC News announced that India may launch a CBDC pilot next year. It said that India is poised to become the fifth largest economy in the world, and then it's only natural, because if China has launched its own CBDC, why shouldn't India? However, you have another entry that said, he has said that while many governments are seemingly interested in issuing or are experimenting with CBDCs, the reality is that it will take several years before such digital currencies are fully rolled out. So you can see that there's pushback there. It continues to say if governments do pull it off, however, it would be very beneficial for crypto, as it would just increase the ease of switching in and out of decentralized crypto such as Bitcoin. So obviously you can see the pushback that's there, but at the same time giving hope to whether the governments around the world can actually pull something like this off. Now, in this program we have suggested how the U.S. dollar will be threatened by the CBDCs, but don't take our word for it. There is another name that you may be familiar with who has stated the same, and that's J.P. Morgan. Has threatened the hegemony of the U.S. dollar by the CBDCs. J.P. Morgan believes that the central bank digital currencies may undermine the hegemony of the U.S. dollar. There is no country with more to lose from the disruptive potential of digital currency than the U.S. J.P. Morgan further added, this revolves primarily around the U.S. dollar hegemony, issuing the global reserve currency and the medium exchange for international trade in commodities, goods, and service, conveys immense advantages. Okay, did you understand what that meant? I mean, what does that exactly mean? We're joining us to explain that and more is Mark Thornton. He's a senior fellow at Ludwig von Mises Institute. All right, Mark, digital currencies, the next wave, as they call it, in evolution of the nature of money for the digital economy, which is something that we're headed down, if not many parts of the world already there. The U.S. has been late in this development, as many have indicated, of what's called the CBDC. Do you think that the U.S. is actually losing the race to adopt one, which is the future of money, as some have said? And also, will it actually doom the almighty dollar, as they call it?
Well, a digital currency issued by the government is rather almost superfluous nowadays, in the sense that we can all engage in electronic transactions via credit cards, debit cards, online transactions. All of these are already happening electronically, and so the absolute value of a Federal Reserve electronic currency, I don't see as being a very powerful and positive right now. Eventually, that's the way the world is going to look. But in terms, so it definitely is the future. But the U.S. Delay in terms of the regulation, that is basically, you know, everybody knows that eventually the economy is going towards digital currencies and cryptocurrencies, of course, which are much more secure and also things that add value over time as well.
All right. Well, let's see what Bill Still, author of The Money Masters, thinks about this. Bill Stills, welcome. Banks are centralized middlemen. We know that when it comes to financial transactions. Now you have digital currencies that perhaps are going to eliminate that. And one particular quote, the more popular cryptocurrency or digital currency becomes, the fewer profits the banking system can actually reap. Does this actually threaten then the U.S. financial system, i.e. the banks? And how will digital currency affect the U.S. economy?
Well, it must be substantial, because there's substantial pressure for them to make the change, and they still resist. So it is that they don't see how they can make nearly as much money as they are right now by allowing moving to a Bitcoin-based economy or their own digital dollar-based economy. No matter how you slice it, their profits, the privately owned central banks' profits, are going to decrease, and not only their profits, but their power. Right now, you know, all additional money that flows into the system has to flow through them and their debt-based system, which is much more empowering to the centralized government than the digital economy. And so the digital economy, by its very nature, provides the citizens, the average person, much more freedom. And that's something that the privately owned central bank system just doesn't like, because that's more freedom for us and less power for them.
It's time now for our Info News section of the program. We are fast approaching the end of the year, but the news revolving around the economy remains hot topics. A new survey came out this past week. It revealed that 83% of millennial millionaires now own crypto. And that's important because, first of all, the generational gap in investment, as they described it, it could create issues for wealth managers. Why is that important? Because that is one way that crypto could negatively affect Wall Street. So it's something for wealth managers in particular to think about. Moving on to our next crypto-related item, dollar to hit zero. That's what it said. This particular headline said, crypto guru has predicted that Americans should stock up on milk and gas because the dollar is about to hit zero. He cited the soaring inflation as one reason, also interest rates going negative as another, and he said that the U.S. dollar will crash in his eyes or in his thinking or in his analysis by the year 2022, and that Americans should stock up on essentials, as we just mentioned, then actually they should go ahead and prepay their bills. Next up, inflation. Gosh, we talk about this in this program so much. And the next two pieces are on that. EU inflation, in this particular piece of news, soaring to 30-year high for 19 EU states. And that's as of the recording of this program. Annual consumer inflation for these 19 EU states surged last month to this record, which is 4.9% from 4.1% a month earlier. And the last time that happened was in the year 1991. And case in point for Europe as a whole, UK, which is not part of the EU, but it recorded its highest inflation in a decade, came in at 5.1%. The rise in consumer prices from fuel to food is bad news for Brits, as they are already suffering from post-Brexit fluctuations. Plus, Prime Minister Boris Johnson, he's facing a test for himself and his party after suffering defeat in the by-elections. Now, those were the news that we picked out again.
Listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
This is our in-depth section. We are going to take a look at what China has given to the U.S. and which many are calling it a gift. Well, you can say it's an unintentional gift. And what is that gift? Crypto mining. Let's look back at the year, well, this year, but at the month, June of 2021. This is when China told its bank to stop facilitating transactions and issued basically a ban on mining, essentially putting a ban on crypto mining as it had launched one of its own digital currencies called the digital yuan. At its peak, 71.70% of all crypto mining in the world took place. So you can see how much of a market share China actually had to that. So when China enacted that crypto ban, obviously it went down in terms of the percentage, which came all the way down to 38%. The crackdown led to this 38% fall in mining globally. So I hope you have us with this particular explanation that we're giving. So you had 71% of the crypto mining in the entire world taking place in China, and then it came down 38% globally because of this. Now, here's where this ban was a gift to the U.S. Let's take a look at how the U.S. crypto mining then picked up as a result of this ban. The activity more than doubled in the 4 months to the end of August. And what happened as a result? It increased U.S. market share to 38%. So you can see where the U.S. was ranking at 3.5% only, and now 38% of all crypto mining is taking place in the United States. Not bad. And that's why we're calling it a gift. Well, Sam Tabar is the chief strategy officer at Minerbit Digital. He has said that China's Bitcoining mining ban was basically an unintentional gift to the U.S., as we just indicated. He also went on to say, thanks to their ban, an entire sector migrated to North America, along with innovation, labor, and machines. So you have people in mining companies in particular that are very happy about that. Now, we want to take a look at this final piece, which is emphasizing what we just said. This is Chad Everett Harris, CEO of Miner Whinstone, which operates the Rockdale site owned by the U.S. company Riot Blockchain. This is what he has said.
China effectively gave the miners of the United States the opportunity.